Leadership shouldn't be about who speaks the loudest, but rather who speaks the truest. I'm Charlotte Otter. Welcome to Speech Bubbles, the podcast that's rewriting the rulebook on leadership, communication, and success. In every episode, we're bursting the bubbles of traditional leadership, bringing you raw, real conversations with trailblazers who don't just challenge the status quo, they obliterate it. We're talking to heads of communication who know the power of words, HR mavericks reshaping workplace culture, and leaders from backgrounds that have been silenced for far too long. This is where vulnerability meets strategy, where authenticity beats artifice, where diverse voices don't just speak, they roar. Whether you're climbing the corporate ladder or building your own, Speech Bubbles is your roadmap to leadership that's human, powerful, and unapologetically you. Are you ready to transform how you communicate, lead, and succeed? Then let's burst some bubbles. My guest today is Meg Baer. Meg is a board member, patent holder, change agent, startup advisor, keynote speaker, serial blogger, TEDx host, and a highly experienced technology leader. She is a non-executive director for Heidrick and Struggles, an executive search firm that builds relationships with the world's most talented individuals on behalf of the world's most successful companies. Her most recent operational role was president for SAP SuccessFactors, where she was responsible for setting product vision, leading product management, engineering, and operations for the entire SuccessFactors product estate and team of over 3,000 people. With more than 30 years of experience in enterprise applications, Meg's expertise spans domains from artificial intelligence, big data, security, customer relationship management, manufacturing, to financial systems and human resources. She has held several leadership and executive positions at Juvo, Imperva, Oracle, PeopleSoft, and Saba. Meg lives and works at the intersection of people, business, and technology. She is committed to using her talents to invent an abundant future by helping others achieve their full potential. Meg says, "I believe deeply that the impacts of our lives are like pebbles on the water, and I'm here to make the biggest splash I can. It's not that I believe the future I plan to invent can be made by myself alone. It is that I know that my ability to galvanize action is a superpower, and I need to use that to the fullest effect." Meg Baer, welcome to Speech Bubbles.
Oh my goodness, thank you for having me. I'm delighted to be part of this amazing podcast.
Oh, thank you so much, Meg. And I love your quote about your superpower being the ability to galvanize action. When and how did you learn that about yourself?
So one of the benefits of building HR software is I've had the opportunity to work with a lot of people that do assessments about strengths and about abilities, about skills, and all of these things. And one of the assessments came back with that language. Another came back with essentially the same construct. And so early in my career, Amy Wilson and I used to joke that my strength was being a used car salesman. But we've come to learn that really what it is about getting people together to do something that they didn't imagine they could do. And for me, that's really, I think, both powerful and important, because most of us hold ourselves back. And I really believe that we should just be pushing forward on everything that we can do to make the world better and to make our own lives as enriched as possible.
But to really galvanize that action, you need to get people behind a vision, which goes to one of the topics of Speech Bubbles, which is, you know, how to communicate as a leader. So how do you attach that inspiring communication and that vision to your concept of the action that you need your teams to put into place?
Yeah. So one of the things that I've learned, and I've learned this really the way you learn the important things in life by getting it wrong a lot. But one of the things I've learned is that the place to start is to understand more about your audience. Really understand who they are, what they value, and why they want to do their best work. Because I strongly believe we all want to do the best that we can, but that definition of best is different for each of us. And so learning to understand and care about the context, the experience, and the beliefs of your audience is the foundation for building a path into something new. And so what I believe strongly is that starting with understanding your audience, having clarity of what it is that you're trying to do, and then building that bridge between those two points is what creates this sort of opportunity for outsized action.
I love that. I often say that leadership is about creating meaning. And that's really what it sounds like you've described to me now, is attaching action and vision by creating meaning for people and for teams. Meg, you've had such a storied leadership career. Where did you start and where are you now?
Yeah, so I started my career somewhat accidentally, as often is the case. My very first job, I joined a tech company, not by design, but somewhat accidentally. And in joining that tech company, I started out in tech support. And what I learned was that I had the ability to connect audiences across different contexts. Now, I didn't understand that as a learning until much later, but that became the foundation of my career, the clarity of communication with customer and what they were trying to accomplish and where that maybe was going wrong, because in tech support, you really are about what's not working. And then over time, building that into a career about innovation and creation, the building of new things that helped deliver to outsized outcomes. And in the way I applied that was always within business technology. So the common theme across my career was both starting with the idea that you can build anything by moving from tech support into engineering, and then investing in expanding to make sure you're building things that actually matter, growing into broader organizational responsibilities, and ultimately running businesses as an operator.
You were one of my interviewees for our We Need New Leaders. And I remember you saying that your first leadership role in tech came very early on. Can you tell us about that?
Early on, I was very insecure. I didn't come with the credentials. I didn't come from a background in tech. I was responsible for things that were real stretches for me, where I had to learn to be able to be capable of doing what was expected in my job. And as that progressed, and as I started to shed that insecurity and start to trust where my strengths were and that my interest in contributing was much more important than my sense of entitlement or credential for how other people perceived me, I started to get initially asked to take on bigger things, because it became really clear that not only was I able to figure stuff out, but I was able to get other people motivated to do that with me. And early on, that looked very much like a normal career progression. You start out, they make you a team leader, then they make you a manager, and you sort of kind of work your way up with technical proficiency. I think where the plot got interesting was in a moment where I was working for yet another very small startup, and I was creating new products and sort of living my best life, a small team, delivering things. It was working out well. Sales team liked it. We were selling a lot of it. And one day I get a call from a colleague who was the head of sales, who said, "Meg, we let go your boss and we are giving you the full responsibility for the engineering team." Now, at the time I was 27, I had, you know, not a ton of job experience, so less than a decade of a job experience. And it was a very small company, but it was a VP role and joining the executive team. And of course, my first response was, "Oh my goodness, I'm not qualified for this." And this is, I think, the moment where I got the best motivation as well as the best clarity. And this colleague said to me, Meg, I would rather have you running this group, knowing nothing about it, than anyone else. And I realized that I was holding myself back in my own belief of what was possible. Now, I was always very confident in what I was good at, but I wasn't really confident in how that contributed in a bigger way. And I realized that that belief was something that I could hold really close and that that could create for me a new path that gave me confidence that my actual skill was doing things I'd never done before.
And that's what you've continued to do throughout your career, is take that self-belief and that confidence to do things you've never done before.
100%. And what I realized is that's where my joy is, because in that space, there's a lot of learning. And for me, learning is something that really inspires and keeps me motivated. So when you talk about meaning, meaning for me is very much tied to the idea that I am personally growing through the combination of both effort and stretch, right? Pushing myself out of my comfort zone.
Another thing you said to me when we were interviewing for We Need New Leaders was, you were so aware that you were the youngest person in the room. It took you a long time to realize you were one of the only women in the room. What was that transition like, and how did you feel about that awareness of diversity or the lack of it in tech?
It's so funny because when you reflect back in your beliefs early on in your career and how they evolve. So as I mentioned, I had a lot of career moments early, and that is actually true. I had a lot of life moments early. I graduated high school at 16. I graduated college at 20, which means that for my own college graduation, I could not legally go to bars. It was a very accelerated path, and I was very determined. I was financially insecure, and so I was very determined to build a sort of solid foundation. And I really believed that the things that were holding me back were perceptions about me, but they were, in my mind, perceptions about youth and inexperience and not coming from an elite school and all of those sorts of imposter syndrome things that you tell yourself that are actually not helpful. And as you say, it wasn't until much later in my career that I realized, oh, wait, there's two things that like became into stark relief. Number one, I was one of the only women in the room most of the time. Why that was unusual for me to notice is that I had throughout my lifetime had a lot more times that I was in circles of men than circles of women. And so it just felt natural to me to be in circles of men. And it didn't even occur to me that I was the only one, because I had lived in that space for a long time. What I realized was a downside of that, and why that became more acute for me, was when I started to recognize hitting a glass ceiling. And I really was so shocked. I had this belief everything was going beautiful and I was having so much acceleration. I couldn't imagine that there was an upper bound. And then when I started hitting the executive ranks at bigger companies, it became starkly clear to me. And it was at that moment I realized two things. I did realize that I was the only woman and that I did not fit patterns that people had preconceived to the leadership positions that I was yearning for and felt very qualified for. And so it was the intersection of those two points where I realized, number one, at this moment in my life, I wasn't the youngest anymore, and that I was the only woman, and that it was no longer as easy for me to unlock opportunity based on my own ability and my own gumption, if you were, that there was a really established perspective that was both gendered and based on a certain set of prior experiences that I did not have. And so I started to have to ask entirely different questions about why is this happening? And then what to do about it. But that realization, I think, was both the intersection of trying to push forward and getting a lot of pushback. I wonder if I hadn't had that, would I have noticed as much that I was an outsider? I don't know if I would have, because I had really shed a lot of the things about my outsider status that were in my own head. And so then I was forced to face, maybe this wasn't me. Maybe this was the context under which I was trying to navigate, and maybe I had to do different things as opposed to just changing my own self-perception. I had to really find a different path to creating opportunity that would promote the upward mobility I was looking for.
It's such a shocking moment, and it happens to so many women and people from diverse identities and backgrounds in corporate, because as a new person in corporate, you think it's you. And so you're constantly working on yourself and what must I do to fix? And that moment where you wake up, and it comes at different points, I think, in people's careers, where you suddenly realize, oh, it's the system. And for me, it was when I had children and suddenly coming back into work and, you know, not getting the remuneration or the fast promotion that my male peers had. It's a really shocking moment when you suddenly realize that it's not actually you. And no matter how much you try to hack or game, that it's a whole system. So what changes did you make, and how did you try to hack or game the system?
I really do also think it's useful to realize that up until that point, my worldview, like all of ours, was very sort of inward and self-focused. And this required me to shift to thinking in terms of an other-focused view in order to navigate that. And one of the side learnings that I observed was the reality that as I had to build systems to navigate around this, I started to realize that even in that, I was still afforded a lot of privilege that other people weren't. So it actually opened my aperture on multiple dimensions in a way that I think was super important, but very, very hard. So I started with what I always start with, which is that when I realize something isn't working, I take a step back and I do a lot of study. I do a lot of sort of introspection and apply a ton of curiosity. And I realized sort of two things. I didn't understand my stakeholders enough to figure out how to help them see me as they needed to see me. Up until then, I had had stakeholders understanding me and providing me opportunity. And it was sort of self-referential. In other words, I did great work for people and they kept promoting me, as you would imagine a normal career progression works. But what I realized in this sort of breakthrough, when you hit a glass ceiling or when you hit a barrier, sometimes those paths no longer serve. And it's not that they aren't important, they're just not sufficient. And so this is where you hear a lot of advice about you need a sponsor, you need whatever, and all of that is true. But I think it requires you to get better at figuring out how to compete. So I told myself an entirely different story because I really did not want to focus on negativity. And I told myself, okay, I'm entering an entirely different league. What got me here won't get me there. And entering this new league, I need to develop new skills that will give me an outside competitive advantage to achieve the goals I want to achieve. So instead of focusing too much on the structural inequality, because I didn't feel like I could change that, I said, how do I outsmart it? And what do I have to bring to bear to do that? And so a couple things that I built as skills in that moment, I had invested in building credibility with stakeholders that I was directly accountable to and building quality teams to help work with me. And so that sort of galvanizing action strength, I had leaned on those, but I had not invested in systems of power, in stakeholders that own different perspectives in the organization, and people who that had control of a broader spectrum. And what I realized is, okay, these bigger roles require more stakeholders to both understand you and champion you. And you need to do that in a way that they can champion you when you're not in the room, when they don't have any reason to be accountable to you directly. And so this required taking a much longer game on relationships, on understanding different stakeholders' needs, and investing in how I could do a better job in supporting and helping people that weren't directly tied to my function or to my immediate success. So started thinking in terms of skip levels above me and started thinking in terms of business problems that were not my direct responsibility, but that I had points of view that could be helpful. And I really just invested in expanding how I was helping others and how I was in thinking about my network as places I could give more as opposed to places that could do more for me. So it took a longer game. I had to play an entirely different strategic game in how I navigated the future. And I had to tell myself that this was going to take longer than the other paths. And that was okay. I wasn't going to feel sorry for myself that my path was going to take longer than someone who fit a biased mold or that had the structural systems kind of paved in their favor. I was going to own the fact that it wasn't about competing. It was about building my own future. And that it was also about expanding how I was showing up in the world and what I was contributing, and that a lot of what I was going to contribute from here forward was not going to be personally beneficial. It was going to be beneficial for others, and that was going to be how I would measure the success.
I love that, Meg, because what you're describing is a much deeper and more intentional form of networking. So, you know, we were always told as women in the workplace, go out and network, find your mentors and find your sponsors. But it's so much deeper and more intentional about that because it's about delivering value and it's about showing skip levels or sideways levels, so parallel levels, that you understand the needs of the business and you have ways to help move things along.
Yeah, and one of the things that I learned in this process, obviously this was a long-term journey for me. It didn't happen overnight. Is that when I reflected at the beginning of this journey, I realized I didn't have great relationships with my peers. In fact, I had great relationships with my boss and great relationships with the teams that worked for me, but my peers saw me as a threat and saw me as somebody that was looking out for my own success at their expense. Now, that was never my intention, but I had to own the fact that that belief was built on some of my behaviors. So I really had to change what was my responsibility to my peers, what was the relationship that mattered to me to build with my peers, and how was I going to be able to do that in a way that fostered more momentum for them and more support for their needs and goals. And I really do think that that was a hard learning for me because my initial point of view about competition has always been to sort of step back because I really don't like the idea of competing for it with a scarcity mindset. And I had to really get, again, deeper in understanding their point of view as opposed to my point of view. And so while I had no intention of being a threat, I had to care about the fact that they saw me as a threat because my success was somehow causing them to feel like their success wasn't as important. And so I really had to shift my own perspective about my role was not to just succeed in my area, but my role was to help more people succeed across more areas. So again, it was a lot of self-reflection and a lot of self-growth in that time frame. A lot of it messy and not fun, but I think important for all the things that have happened to me since then.
Yeah, it clearly worked. What was coming up for me as you were talking, I was thinking, This is a whole new set of emotional labor that you're doing on top of being successful in your actual job. This emotional labor about thinking of your different audiences and your managers, your step leaders, your peers, your team. That's a lot of additional brain power and emotion that is going into managing your career. But it was successful for you, which was wonderful. And I'd love to jump now to your most senior leadership roles and talk about how you thought of your leadership style and how you like to communicate it.
Obviously, leadership styles evolve and mine is no different. I think as I stepped into more senior leader roles, it became clear to me that giving up direct control was a big part of it. So helping people underneath me thrive. Now, I've always been somebody that's really cared about my teams and their success and their growth. But what I've come to learn over time as an executive leader is that when you have very senior people, they have a lot of horsepower. And your job as a coach and a supporter of that horsepower is really twofold. You know, get them in their power alley, make sure that you're helping them understand where they're uniquely gifted and how they can have outsized impact. Invest in helping them see you as a thought partner as opposed to just somebody they do things for. And for me, what really important is build a team that feels very comfortable in challenging my points of view. I'm a very strong opinionated person. I have a very strong approach to how I bring ideas forward. And I need to make sure that my team feels comfortable and confident to both tell me when I'm wrong and really debate how we should be doing things differently based on what they're seeing on the ground and based on their strengths and abilities to execute. So it's much more than just delegation. It's really about valuing the strength and the horsepower that leadership it brings to you when you have very senior leaders and making sure that you don't try to make everybody in your image, but that you really understand that it's their ability to do things you can't is what you need as an executive leader. And so you really need to lean into that and you really need to care about that for how you help them and also how you help yourself.
So two things come to mind as you're talking. That word that you used, horsepower, in terms of really sort of attaching to the value and what your most senior leaders and your team can bring, made me think of your quote about galvanizing action. It took me back to the quote at the beginning. But also when you talked about encouraging debate, it led me to think about radical candor, which is creating the psychological safety so that a team can be brutally honest with each other and engender that creative abrasion around ideas so that once you've finished the debating, you're all on the same page about how you're going to go forward. And that is a form of communication, isn't it?
Yeah, one other thing I think that I've grown to learn is that my communication, so my understanding of what needs to happen is very much built on intuition. It is often in the nonverbal parts of my experience and expertise. And one of the challenges I have is that oftentimes I assume that people are following along that same plot line as me because we're looking at a lot of the similar data. Of course, what's missing is that that's a unique strength of mine. And because it's done for me at a nonverbal level, it's actually more work for me to break that down. So one of the tools that I try to use for this is, number one, share things that I'm seeing early and often so that people can come along that journey with me. And then number two, build a very strong cultural norm to say, to force people to stop me and say, Meg, you're not making any sense. Break it down further so that I have to stop and turn my nonverbal understandings and intuitions into component parts that other people can process and digest. So it's really important for me to have people around me that are good at understanding where I'm kind of going off the rails for them and for others, so that I can get better about getting my message more clear. So anytime I'm pushing people into new spaces and new innovations, this is where this comes up in a big way, because it is easy for me to make leaps that I don't realize I've even made. And so turning that into coherent language and turning that into something that anyone else could understand, that's not inside my head, which, God help them, that's a dangerous place to be. I think there's a lot of deconstruction in that. And so having thought partners that help me see what isn't landing, what doesn't make sense, is also a really important part of this process. Because otherwise, I suspect that people understand and are following my ideas and realize later, like, oh, they had no idea what I meant. So it's like, that's one of my challenges, is to break things down. And I think that's why I write a lot, because it forces me to take an end idea and break it down into something that then could make more sense to more people. It's just, it takes me longer to do that part of the process than to understand where I'm going.
That's lovely. And I do remember that another pillar of your communication style that you've told me about before is listening. You're very, very interested in making sure you're listening to what's going on in the organization. Could you talk about that a bit?
Yeah. So when you run really big organizations and they're global, listening needs to come in multiple flavors. One of the things that I do, so language really matters to me. I don't just listen for what people say, but I also listen for how they say it and try to use that to learn more about where they're coming from and how they see the world. So most people, when they do things like engagement surveys, they spend time on the heat maps, they spend time on the kind of summarization information. I'm a little bit the opposite. I read every single comment. Now, I have the advantage, I read very fast, but I spend the time to go and read all the comments. And then I try to understand, okay, where are they coming from? And it's in that place that I learn a whole lot of not just what people are saying, but how they're saying it and why they're saying it. And it creates for me an opportunity to understand context and have more empathy. So when I say listening, I think of it as a multi-channel thing. I'm listening on the asynchronous tools we have. I'm listening on formal surveys where people are asked to give feedback. I'm going around and doing small group listening. I'm doing, you know, on stage types of events where large groups are asking questions in public. But I'm investing in not just the topics people want to ask, but the way they want to ask them and the language that they use, because I believe that underneath all of that, I can develop a better ability to tailor my communication towards them and have a better appreciation for my own blind spots of what is the lived reality for people in this context, in this region, in this market segment, in this cultural scenario. And that becomes really important when you lead global teams, because there is not one universal lived experience. There's a lot of consistency and it's becoming more homogenized, but the lived experience is still very, very different and very individualized. And so I care about listening across all of those types of dimensions.
So we've talked about leadership. We've talked a bit about diversity. We started to talk about communication. I'd now love to explore reputation a little bit, and I'd love to know how you think about your reputation now. What are the elements of reputation that are important to you?
Yeah, so when I started thinking about this, and again, I think it was all around the same time as I was thinking about trying to punch into real executive ranks, it was also the moment of time where reputations started to look very different as it became more media driven and online. So the combination of all of those have been part of my own evolution. I do strongly believe your reputation is what people say about you, not what you think you're saying or what you want to say. But I've also had the benefit of living my life out loud and visibly online for a fair bit of time. And so I've had the opportunity to get feedback on how people see me and how they understand me. And so what I love about that is the more that I get those feedback loops, the more I can ask myself, is this how I want to be seen? And is this serving me? And is this my best self or not? And, you know, obviously sometimes it is and sometimes it isn't. But I'm really pleased to say that, like, the thing that I have going for me, I think that a lot of people struggle with, is because I started as an outsider and because I knew that going in the path that was pre-paved or well understood was never going to work for me, I really did not feel constrained at all about how I would show up. Instead, I got to ask myself, what do I value and how do I want to serve? And so for me, building a public presence and a public persona and a point of view was very, very intentional. Now, I evolved, but it was very intentional. And I think the other thing that's really interesting about me is, like, I even got involved in social media starting professionally. Like, my first Facebook friends were professional colleagues, not family or friends or acquaintances or whatever. And so I started out with a very specific understanding of, I'm going to have to think about integrating how I show up overall and who do I want to be in public? Like, how public do I want to be and who do I want to be in public? And I realized that I'm much more comfortable than most people about being who I am and not worrying about how other people perceive that. I have a strong belief, like, that is, each of us perceive the world based on our own things, and we can't control that anyway. So being true to my values, being clear about who I am and what I care about, and investing in the places that matter to me. And it really matters to me that what I realize is that I have had the benefit of experiences that other people haven't had, and I am good at understanding what those things might mean as it relates to trends and as it relates to opportunities. And so I feel really compelled to share what I've learned. And I realize that that's what I do. And that's why my reputation matters, is that I want people who are eager to understand what I've learned and be part of that journey with me to be attracted to me. And I don't care, really. If it doesn't work for you, then I think that's great. And so I don't write for people to read it. I write because I have something to say and for it to be there when people need it. It doesn't have to happen in my time frame. And I'm not thinking about how my trending is going, or I just don't really mind that there doesn't have to be a big outcome. To me, it's about living my values and it's about contributing in a way that matters to me for the future that I want to create.
That's so lovely. And I can strongly recommend that people go and follow your blog, which I think you've been writing since 2012.
Actually, been a little longer. I think I started blogging on a different platform and I think 2007, actually.
Wow. Well, what I've seen starts on 2012 on your MegBear.com website. So many ideas, so much wealth and so much richness. I think people could really get a lot of value out of following you. So Meg, we're coming towards the end. I have one last question and then I'm going to my three standard questions. And my last question is, you know my passion for changing leadership archetypes. We have a very old-fashioned, old-school leadership archetype in our minds of what leaders look like. What can we do collectively and individually to change that tired leadership archetype?
I think it's on those of us that can to continue to hold space and to show alternate points of view. I take very, very seriously the fact that role models matter and that it is my responsibility to show how I got to where I got so that other people can follow. And so I just encourage everyone to take seriously that your success and your excellence, while it is great for yourself, think about what it can mean to others and think about how you can use that combination to benefit future. Because what we're struggling with as it relates to opening up opportunities is battling pattern recognition that biases in a pattern that is not as diverse as it needs to be. So setting aside all of the political drama and all of that, we need to show better pattern recognition. And I think each of us can contribute to that with our own abilities and our own unique gifts. So I just encourage everyone to take seriously that what you do matters.
And I would add speaking about it as well, not just doing it, but
exactly.
Creating that amazing record of success and talking about it.
Yes, I love that. Yes, 100%.
Yeah. Meg, so our standard questions, give us a book recommendation.
All right. So I have two for your specific audience, which is really about thinking about diversity and leadership. So the first one is He, She, They. I've read that recently in an attempt to get better informed for myself on gender nonconformity, and I found it delightful and lovable and an amazing role modeling from a very young, amazing human that I just like wish I had that maturity in my 20s that Skylar has. So it really great read for anybody that's interested in that. And then my second book recommendation is Invisible Women. Invisible Women talks about data gaps that are specifically gendered data gaps. But I think in the day of AI, I think it's really important that we ask ourselves what data are we not capturing and why. And so I think both of those will expand your view of maybe some blind spots you have, maybe help galvanize a little bit of action on how you think about the future.
Lovely. Thank you for those. And what are your three tips for emerging leaders from diverse backgrounds who want to build amazing leadership careers?
So number one, get clear on your personal strength and unique value proposition. Let go of the idea that you've got to follow someone else's pattern. Get really clear what you do that is uniquely special and valuable, because that will help you position yourself for success. Number two, learn perspective taking. Not just because you have a benefit of being able to have different perspectives than others, but it will also build tools that you can use as bridges for systems of power. And then the last one is take smart risks. Don't hold yourself back against a world that's already holding you back. So when things aren't working, try some new things, because seriously, that's what the world needs. And breaking patterns really is helpful across every part of your career journey.
Oh, I love that message about breaking patterns. I think it's wonderful. The world is a little bit heavy at the moment. We are all struggling one way or another. What's bringing you joy?
So joy for me comes in a few packages. Number one, deep and thought-provoking conversations. So people like yourself, Charlotte, that help me think differently is super joy-inducing. Dancing. I'm a big fan of dancing. Reading. I like to read all the things. And thinking deeply about the future. I know that is completely nerdy, but also fully on brand. I get joy in leaning into all the things that make me me.
That is so beautiful. Meg Bear, thank you so much for joining me on Speech Bubbles.
You've been listening to another production from Solid Gold Podcasts.